National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. We're going to discuss the globally important issue of human rights today. One of the most important world powers today doesn't have a great track record on respecting and honoring human rights, and we're going to take a deep dive into the Chinese government's behavior toward not only Chinese dissidents, but also ethnic and religious minorities throughout China. With us to discuss these issues is an expert on these issues. Nuri Turkel is an attorney, China expert, and rights advocate with nearly two decades of experience working in the intersection of law, business, government, and the human rights community. He specializes in corporate governance and regulatory compliance, national security, foreign policy, digital authoritarianism, and forced labor and supply chain risk issues. He is currently serving as chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom after being appointed as a commissioner by Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi in May of 2020. He has testified before the U.S. Congress, speaking about Uyghur internment camps and advocating a legislative response to China's atrocities. His policy recommendations have been incorporated into U.S. laws and pending bills relating to Uyghurs and China. As a rights advocate, he has led efforts to raise the profile of the Uyghur cause, previously as the president of the Uyghur American Association, and now chair of the Uyghur Human Rights Project, which he co-founded in 2003. He also advised past and present leadership of the World Uyghur Congress. Nuri Turkel is a senior fellow at the Washington think tank, the Hudson Institute, where he works on U.S. foreign policy and national security issues. He's also a life member of the Council on Foreign Relations. His policy-oriented essays appeared in major publications such as Foreign Affairs, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times Foreign Policy, Time, Newsweek, and USA Today. He frequently provides commentaries on TV and radio programs, including CNN, BBC, Radio Free Asia, Fox News, PBS, NPR, Al Jazeera, and France 24. In 2020, Nuri Turkel was in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World list, and in 2021, he was listed as one of Fortune's 50 Greatest Leaders. In 2021, he also received the inaugural Notre Dame Prize for Religious Liberty. Nuri Turkel holds a Juris Doctorate and a Master of Arts in International Relations from the American University. Nuri Turkel, thank you for joining us today. Welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you very much, John, for having me on.
And where are you this morning? You and I are up on Zoom so we can see each other, but where are you sitting?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
Okay. All right. So I think it's really important for our discussion today for our listeners to learn a little bit more about your background and experiences so they can really understand why your expertise is so profoundly impactful on this topic. Nuri, could you tell us about your journey to the United States and how you got into this topic of human rights and international law?
Thank you, John. It's a great question. I was born in a re-education camp during the height of the Cultural Revolution in 1970, where my newly wedded mother was taken into the re-education camp by the Mao's Red Guards, where my father was sent to forced labor camps in an area 3 hours away from home. I was born in a re-education camp. Not only that, I spent the first several months of my life in this world, suffering alongside of my mother in a Red Guard-run re-education camp, which is very similar to the ones that we are discussing and trying to shut down in communist China. My journey is essentially started the way that I was brought to this world. I was reminded every day, literally as I grow up, that my mother and I specifically went through such a horrific experience. Even in some instance, we walked by the building where my mother and I were kept or detained early on. And after finishing my primary and secondary education, I went to study in inland China, and I witnessed the experience actually the the opening of China at the same time, the post June 4th Tiananmen massacre opening, that China opened its doors to the West. We start seeing more Americans and Europeans. At the same time, I read about the Cold War ending next door in my homeland, in sister homeland, East Turkestan, with that China calls Xinjiang. And I was inspired to go to America. I came to America and then realized that the situation is getting worse and worse. So starting 2001, right after 9/11, I become very active in the Uyghur human rights work, because China opportunistically misused U.S.-led war on terrorism for its advantage, calling the entire population as terrorists, using its economic and diplomatic influence to advance or justify its brutal crackdown of the Uyghur people. So in the past 20 years, I got involved in policy advocacy work, setting up, managing, and expanding in a human rights organization. In the last 4 years in particular, I've been immersed in the work specifically in Washington and capitals of our traditional allies and partners, advocating for strong policy responses to stop the ongoing genocide and shut down the industrial-scale concentration camps that the Communist China set up to hold millions of innocent Uyghur people, including children.
So, Neri, you're an expert on this, on international laws for human rights. How exactly does international law frame human rights? I mean, how do nations around the world not only abide by these legal frameworks, but how are they held accountable when they actually violate what the international standards are for human rights? Can you talk? I mean, you're a lawyer. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yes, the human rights are enshrined in international law initially through the UN Declaration of Human Rights. They generally agreed to be the foundation of international human rights law, which was adopted in 1948. The UN Declaration of Human Rights has inspired a rich body of legally binding international human rights treaties, to which specifically Communist China is a signatory state party to, that they regularly violates. And the human rights framework gives a meaning to concepts like dignity, fairness, respect, and autonomy. These concepts often gives a rise in the context of inspection, investigation, reporting by international bodies and various state parties to the convention and treaties. The international human rights laws are built on specifically three pillars. We're talking about UN general principle, protection, respect, and remedy. That is essentially the framework. And there are seven main international human rights that includes right to vote, right to freedom of association, right to fair trial, right to privacy, and right to freedom of religion. So these are the rights that the states supposedly respect and protect. Ironically, as I noted earlier, the Chinese state violates UN Declaration of Human Rights and various other international laws that they sign on to, including International Covenant on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, International Covenant Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhumane, Degrading Treatment and Punishment. We call it CAT. And also, ironically, China is also a signatory to a state party to the Genocide Convention. And ironically, the China also violates its own constitution because of the through the repressive policies that the international community has learned in recent years. So there's no lack of Chinese commitment to the international law, there's no insufficient laws to protect human rights under the auspices of international law, under the auspices of UN. But it has been on paper only. This makes us to believe whether or not UN needs to overhaul the international law in the maybe post-Ukraine invasion by Putin, Putin's Russia, need to look at the international system that countries like Russia and China not only wanted to cause damages, destroy, even change. So we need to come up with a new thinking, new strategy to put in place. I can talk about this a little bit more details, but essentially the point I'm making is that the China violates its international commitment right and left, back and forth, quite regularly, without any consequences, if I may add.
Yeah. So we're certainly focused on China today, but I do want to take advantage of the fact that you're on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and you're also, you know, a foreign policy guy. You're thinking about national security issues all the time. I would frame it that once Russia invaded Ukraine, all of the stuff that was sort of below the table in this, I guess, a global challenge between the liberal democratic order and the rising autocratic order around the world went from sort of being under the table to being sort of issue number one. And we've seen a backtrack in democracy around the world. As a member of this Religious Freedom Commission, is your commission seeing the same kinds of things with regards to religious freedom around the world? I mean, China is an obvious example, but are you seeing it elsewhere in the world as well as part of this sort of loss of freedoms and democracy around the planet?
The democracy is in decline for a variety of reasons.
Sure.
We all know that. We have a problem with the bad guys around the world, as Anne Applebaum wrote a few months ago in The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. What gives us a concern as a government agency and a society is that we cannot push aside human rights concerns, religious freedom issues on the side. We'll put it on the back burner. We'll talk about it when it's convenient, politically expedient, and then just ignore it when it becomes an issue in much broader and bigger national security issues. Late Senator John McCain wrote a piece in spring 2017, essentially calling the United States government out for mismanagement of human rights-centric. We're not focusing on human rights-centric foreign policy agenda. Whenever the United States and our traditional allies and partners speak out in one voice on human rights, in defense of human rights, democratic values, it resonates in people who are demanding these kind of freedoms around the world, sacrificing their lives and risking their safety. At the same time, these kind of messages, coherent, consistent messages, will be heard in the capitals of dictatorship around the world, including the ones in Beijing, Moscow, Tehran, Caracas, you know, all those places. So we need to look at this issue, issue of human rights and religious freedom in the context of national security. The reason I've been advocating this through my government position, because we monitor some of the worst human rights violators around the world, that includes countries like Burma, China, Cuba, Eritrea, India, Iraq, and also we have been monitoring North Korea, Russia, for example, Saudi Arabia. So all of these countries persecute their religious minority. For China, for example, has been on the list of country of particular concern, CPC, since a year after the International Religious Freedom Act was enacted in 1998. So we're talking about a country that has been on the blacklist, on the top of the religious freedom violators, on the top of the list. But when you look at the list of countries that we monitor and call out publicly and make policy recommendations to the State Department, Secretary of State, President, and Congress, essentially boils down to something very simple. If you fail to address these issues, human rights issues, religious freedom issues, essentially becomes humanitarian disaster.
Right.
In some cases, it becomes a genocidal campaign. Yeah. In the case of Yazidis in Iraq, in Syria, in the case of Rohingyas in Burma, and the case of Uyghurs now in China. So do we have to wait until it becomes a huge national security concern or humanitarian crisis for us to act upon on national security and foreign policy perspective? I don't think that that should be the norm. So the USERF, my agency, uses international standards to promote freedom of thought, freedom of religion around the world, essentially making the case that whenever the society, a country, respects human rights, religious freedom, that naturally brings prosperity and stability. You don't have to persecute a vulnerable ethnic and religious minority to achieve national security. But conversely, if you respect those rights, you will naturally get a national security guarantees or even stability and prosperity that you try to use as a justification for persecution. So the agency that I have been appointed and now serving in the leadership role have been advocating even our government to make sure that the religious freedom, human rights are an integral parts of U.S. foreign policy agenda.
Yep. So I like what you're saying. I'm always in favor of a proactive foreign policy rather than reactive, because I think you can set the agenda more effectively that way. For our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Nuri Turkel, and we're discussing China's human rights violations. Nuri, let's dive much deeper now into China's treatment of dissidents, both ethnic and religious minorities as well. I'd like to begin with China's treatment of the religious groups like Falun Gong. Most people probably remember hearing about them some years ago. There are probably many other religious minority groups. But from your studies, what issue did the Chinese Communist Party have with the Falun Gong movement? And this can just be brief. There's a lot we can talk about this morning.
Yes, absolutely. The Falun Gong is a spiritual practice whose key features essentially of mediation, meditating, and exercise, teaching reminiscence of Buddhism and Taoist tradition, which is part of a Chinese cultural tradition, essentially. But the Chinese government does not tolerate, Communist Party does not tolerate any religious practices, even though the rites of worship, religious practices are enshrined in China's constitution, China's autonomy laws, Chinese propaganda documents. Starting through 1990s, Chinese authorities, specifically in 1999, abruptly banned this spiritual group, claiming that they are a cult. That's a convenient term, accusation that not only we've seen in China, but elsewhere as well. So they got very aggressive. Apparently, there are 70 million followers, followers in China. And also, it exceeded the numbers of Chinese Communist Party members in 1999, which estimated to be about 63 million. So 70 million Falun Gong practitioners versus 63 million Chinese Communist Party members in 1999 gave a huge concern to Chinese Communist Party leadership. So they think this is a threat. That's how this persecution started. And the reason being is this. When you look at the Chinese constitution, Chinese propaganda material, it looks innocuous, looks admirable, even when it comes to individual rights, because they all say it all the right thing, as if that sometimes it makes you feel that you're reading a document from some democratic nation. But the thing that the Chinese Communist Party does not say in its documents, propaganda materials, public speeches, some instances, speeches by senior leadership, is that they're fearful of religion. Western religion is, in particular, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Judaism is not one of the large religious group in China, but there's some aspect. But the main focus is the Christians and the Muslims. They believe, the Chinese leadership believe, that any type of religious practices that promotes freedom of thought, freedom of worship, freedom of press, freedom of speech, that goes on the face of the communist ideology. Anyone who read George Orwell's 1984 would be surprised how much similarities there in China between what George Orwell warned us versus what the Chinese state says, does on a regular basis. So they believe that any type of religious practices, let alone being having a number of followers more than the Communist Party members, is a threat to the state. It could be a potential source of instability, political upheaval. Therefore, they do everything that they can think of to crush any demand, practices with a large congregation. So when you look at it, that's essentially the problem that the Chinese government wrongfully identifies, and that leading to some of the repressive persecution of religious practitioners.
Okay. And we know that the United Kingdom had handed control of Hong Kong back to China as the British Empire resolved to end most of their colonial holdings. And that year was 1997, and China agreed then to allow Hong Kong to be under a one-nation, two-systems arrangement for the next 50 years. China clearly has reneged on that agreement, and the past few years have seen a serious crackdown on citizens in Hong Kong who are demanding the rights they'd been promised back in 1997. How egregious a violation of international norms and international agreements has China committed with their actions in Hong Kong, and how have dissidents in Hong Kong and around China been treated in the past decade? I'm talking about, you know, specifically political dissidents now.
The losing Hong Kong, I believe, is one of the biggest strategic blunder that the international community has made. I think that the losing Hong Kong, the way that we have in such a quick, short period of time, it essentially shows the true nature of the Communist Party leadership. Mm. You can see a sense of urgency, sense of impatience, a sense of brutality, a sense of greed as well. The Chinese did not have to append Hong Kong democracy to solidify its rule. Hong Kong people, Hong Kongers, were already agreed to be part of mainland China. Excuse me.
Yep.
With the agreement that Chinese will not touch one nation, two system arrangement for 50 years. So the Chinese broke their own pledge to the people of Hong Kong, to the international community. So how it started, starting from, excuse me, starting from 2003, Hong Kong government proposed national security legislation that would have prohibited treason, secession, sedition, subversion against the Chinese government. excuse me. And then in 2012, they did something very similar to what the central government of Beijing has done to the Uyghurs, essentially amending the education curriculum. In the Uyghur case, not only the curriculum, but also the language was switched from Uyghur language to Mandarin Chinese. And then just gradually, and then in 2015, Beijing proposed a framework for universal suffrage, allowing Hong Kongers to vote for the city's chief executive, but not only from Beijing-approved short list of candidates. Note that. That's very important. It's a showcase.
Right.
But you have to... You can vote, but the voting has to be on the individuals previously approved by Beijing. So Hong Kong people who had the taste of freedom for so long did not like it. They organized massive rallies known as Umbrella Movement to call for true democracy. And the Beijing obviously could not tolerate that. And then they start stepping up the efforts to rein in dissidents, including the persecuting of protest leaders, expelling several new legislators, and increasing media censorship. The real turning point was in June 2020, where they imposed, passed the Hong Kong legislation, and known as the National Security Law. That legislation essentially effectively criminalized any dissent and adopts extremely broad definition of definitions for crimes such as terrorism, subversion, secession, and collusion with foreign powers. And note, collusion with foreign powers can be anything. If you have a communication with foreign leaders, in the case of Jimmy Lai, the revered businessman who is in jail today, his collusion was coming to Washington, talking to the officials in the previous administration. That includes Vice President Mike Pence and then the former Secretary of State, Michael Pompeo. So with that, essentially, Hong Kong ended. Hong Kong freedom, Hong Kong democracy was destroyed. And now the Chinese supported Hong Kong police, Hong Kong administration, is going even more brutal, becoming more brutal, arresting Cardinal Zen, the top Catholic leader, and also rounding up democracy leaders, including Joshua Wong. Recently, they even detained my good friend Dennis Fo, with whom I shared the stage at the Oslo Freedom Forum in 2019. So this is an ongoing repression, and the international community has not done enough to make it costly for Xi Jinping's China to not only erode Hong Kong democracy, but continuing to round up those peaceful democracy activists who have rightfully, legitimately opposed Beijing rule.
Yeah, I want to follow that up with another quick question here, Nuri. I mean, your national security background, your foreign policy expertise, your expertise on China, how much is this being driven by Xi Jinping himself and how he views not only his current role, but maybe his legacy as the leader of China? Is this Chinese Communist Party is that driving it, or is it Xi Jinping himself, do you think, that is driving a lot of this?
It's both. Chinese Communist Party is essentially sets the tone. This is such an interesting topic that most American people don't really understand. This may sound patronizing, but
no. Educate us, please.
the Communist Party is essentially sets the stage for everything. In our system, for example, we have Congress, we have administration, we have a healthy debate in public through media, through various think tank events, publications. There's a wide range of topics people can even protest our government. None of this is available for the citizens of the People's Republic of China. The Communist Party, known as the CCP publicly, selects who runs the party. In the case of Xi Jinping, he was selected by Communist Party elders. And also on the provincial level, every province has a Communist Party chief that is also selected by the Communist Party apparatus in Beijing. That Communist Party leadership is actually higher ranking official than the governor. Just imagine that I know it's not a perfect example, but a state of California has a governor, and yet some party official sits on top of him, essentially controls everything. So this is a setup. at how the system has been set up. And then two interesting aspect is China's national security, national defense, domestic policies, monetary policies, economic policies, trade policies, all set by Communist Party. Therefore, our Secretary of State cannot call his Chinese counterpart, Minister of Foreign Affairs, as his real same level counterpart. In the Chinese system, for example, the Chinese Minister of Foreign Affairs is a low-ranking official, unlike our Secretary of State. So it's a mismatching. But the real person who calls the shot within the Communist Party is the person who is the Director of Foreign Affairs within the Communist Party, not the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So essentially, this is a Communist Party problem that we're dealing with. But the Xi Jinping has been an effective enforcer, ambitious enforcer of the Communist Party. And also, I might add, a very impatient enforcer of the Communist Party.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We haven't seen nearly the kind of aggressive behavior coming out of China that in the past that we've seen under Xi Jinping. No question about it.
Absolutely. Does he have to commit a genocide to solidify his power? Absolutely not. Does he have to be alienated as he has? Absolutely not. Probably not. And does he have to be destroying Hong Kong democracy the way it has to have a full control? Absolutely not. But this man is not normal. When you listen to his speech, particularly number 9 document as known, which is available on Wikipedia, he specifically highlighted his national security agenda, his foreign policy agenda. One of the things that he commonly used to describe his approach to international community is China is in constant battle against the West. That what does it mean? Why the American policymakers, American general public don't appreciate that? So if a country is in a constant battle against the West, which is us, the United States, then we have to revisit our position. I am pleased with the awakening that we're experiencing in the United States. This is not about a particular U.S. government official making inflammatory statement, a provocative statement against a communist state, or any politician trying to hold a higher office to make a public statement. This is actually a rude awakening for American people. This regime, this communist regime, this a genocidal regime that we're dealing with is essentially a threat to our national security. Yesterday, something remarkable happened in our country that U.S. Congress passed a law, Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, last December that signed into law right before Christmas, went into effect yesterday, which essentially addresses some of the lingering national security economic issues since China joined the WTO. Essentially, we Americans been complicit in the ongoing slavery of our fellow human being because we're addicted to cheap products that we buy from our stores, the Walmart, Target, Costco, and elsewhere. So China is not only causing various national security threats and challenging our global leadership, that also, in a way, in very skillfully altering our way of life in America. Today, when you look at the sports world, for example, NBA does not raise a finger because there's a huge market for NBA athletic programs, broadcasts, and advertisement. Hollywood does not say anything because China has become the largest market for motion pictures. U.S. academia, because of China's bullying and harassing of academics, will not comfortably go out to public to say anything negative about communist China because they still want to have access to China to continue to their research research and writing and this lucrative speaking arrangements that China makes an arrangement for them. Think tanks is another beauty in Washington. A lot of think tanks are tainted by Chinese money. So they are, in a way, gradually, very strategically, effectively, changing our way of dealing with despots, authoritarian dictatorship. authoritarian regime and dictatorship around the world. So this is a national security threat. So I wanted to point this out to your listener that when you hear Joe Biden and Donald Trump speaking in the same, using the same language to describe China, you should not be surprised, because they've been doing this to us as a country in the last 20, 30 years. You know, if I borrow a former U.S. Vice President's alliance at the Hudson Institute in October 2018, we Americans, the United States, helped to build China. And they've been eating our lunch for so long.
Yeah.
So if this does not wake us up, if this genocidal regime that we have a business relationship with, a diplomatic relationship with, that daily or regularly threaten our interest, try to cause harm to our interest, and also engage in transnational repression, and also in a broad daylight, making us all complicit in the ongoing genocide, then I don't know what will wake us up. So this is a wake-up call for those of us live in freedom, those of us care for future, those of us care for democratic freedoms, human lives, need to speak out, because this is a critical moment in our time that we are still appear to be. I think the situation is a little better in the United States, but Europeans, you know, I can express my disapproval and disappointments about some of the European nations, but I think we're on the right track. At least we have recognized this danger on the technological aspect, in economical aspect, society aspect, societal aspect, educational aspect, you name it. In everything that we're dealing with, we appreciate in this country, has been challenged by China.
So I'm very glad I asked that follow-up question about Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party. I got you on a roll there, Nuri. Hey, listen, let's move to the situation with which you are very familiar, the Chinese government's treatment of the Uyghur minority in Xinjiang in Western China. Can you give us a kind of a detailed understanding of what's actually happening in Xinjiang and what China has done to the Uyghur people in the region, really, especially, I'd say, over the last decade? And then we'll move on from there.
The as reported in the last 3-4 years, as recognized by two administrations, the Trump administration, Biden administration, and seven other parliaments and governments around the world, Communist China is committing genocide and crimes against humanity in the Uyghur homeland, locking up anywhere between 1.8 million to 3 million Uyghurs in the industrial-scale concentration camps, and enslaving the Uyghurs in the global supply chain. More than 80 global brands that most of the global consumers use on a daily basis have been reportedly produced by enslaved Uyghurs. Close to 1,800,000 to 1 million Uyghurs have been taken into the children's camps, much like the way that Hitler did. And also, China has been actively engaging in transnational repression around the world, even in our homeland right here, posing a sovereignty threat, try to silence not only their former subjects, the Uyghurs, who become a U.S. citizen in our country, and also those sympathetic to the Uyghur cause. And then finally, they also have turned the Uyghur homeland into an open-air prison through this massive surveillance apparatus that it set up, through sending Chinese cadres to sleep and eat, and in some instances commit sexual violence against individuals at their homes. Mm. This has all been reported. If you spend a few minutes just to Google Uyghur genocide, Uyghur slave labor, you'll be surprised how much information that are available. And you'll be feeling, some of feel sorry for you to missing one of the worst human rights crises that the world has not seen since the Holocaust. As has been noted by senior government officials, policy experts, civil society leaders, that the international community, the world has not seen anything like this, this level of brutality on the ethno-religious minority since the Nazi era. The international community made a promise, never again, but never again ring hollow today because of the tepid, meandering responses that has been shown to the Chinese crimes that is still ongoing. Secretary State Blinken noted the other day when he delivered China's speech that the genocide against the Uyghurs are still underway. This should be disturbing to American people who love freedom and care for those who are voiceless and subject to this kind of brutal crimes. The Uyghur genocide is in its sixth year. I can give you a little bit more of a comparative analysis between how international community responded to Ukrainian crisis versus the Uyghur crisis, which is a day and night difference. Just one example, there have been a worldwide condemnation, high-level visits to war zone, even by top Defense and State Department official representing the United States government. Even Speaker Pelosi, who appointed me in my government position, went to Ukraine to meet with President Zelensky. And less than a week after Putin invaded Ukraine, we have seen about 100 companies around the world, global brands, either suspended or pulled out of Russia, suspended their business practice or completely pulled out of Russia in response to Putin's illegal invasion of Ukraine, causing or committing war crimes. And conversely, when it comes to the Uyghur crisis, Uyghur genocide, there's no single company, as we are in it's 6 years of this genocide, even publicly pledged that they will stop doing business in China in response. And make the matter worse, actually they are funding the ongoing, fueling the ongoing genocide. For example, in February, this past February, when China held the Winter Olympics, some of the global major brands, including Visa, Coca-Cola, Nike, Procter & Gamble, Omega, sponsored this genocide Olympics. And the International Olympic Committee did nothing to stop this genocide. It could have stopped it. So there has been a miserable failure in the international community's part. And making it clear to the Chinese that the Xi Jinping's China, that the international community will not speak out, will not do what is necessary because it's too costly. This may be something that your listener find objectionable, but I might add that we don't have to show the level of response that we have shown in the case of Ukraine simply because the people who are suffering look like us. We also need to show that kind of compassion and support to those who may not share some similar physical appearance, who may not share a similar religious background, who may not share or confront similar type of adversaries. In the case of Uyghurs, the CCP. Yes, it could be costly, but in the long run, history rewards those who are on the right side of the history. And the history will be unkind to those like Noel Chamberlain who end up being on the wrong side of the history.
Yeah. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Nuri Turkel, and we're discussing China's violations of international human rights law. So Nuri, all the things you've been describing to us are absolutely horrible. I think we've done a phenomenal job this morning of covering sort of China's international human rights violations, the lack of strong response from the international community to address these issues, especially in the Xinjiang region of China. I was hoping to ask you specifically about, why Americans should, sit up and take notice of this from a national security perspective. You have already outlined that incredibly well for us. I think you've made a heck of a case in the International Court of Law as to why Americans should be more aware of what's happening in China and demanding greater action. You mentioned the law that just took effect yesterday for the Uyghurs. I think that's a great step forward. Obviously, there's an awful lot more we want to cover. I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about your recent book. No Escape is the title of that book. Why did you decide to write this book, and why'd you title it No Escape?
John, if I may, I'd like to thank you so much. I will, before I move on to the book, I need to say something really quickly
yeah,
about
absolutely.
The miserable failure of our international system, specifically the UN. Those of you who are following the news recently may have noticed that the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, just completed a visit to China. And she whitewashed essentially the ongoing genocide. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is one of the world's custodian of justice, civil liberties, and accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever holds that job is essentially should be looked as a moral leader because you are a champion of human rights.
Yeah.
And a commissioner's job, for example, shine a clear, robust, and unambiguous spotlight on human rights atrocities like the one that has happened to the Uyghurs. And yet she even did not know what her job responsibility and real responsibility. She ended up trying to engage in political and diplomatic engagements or negotiations with the Chinese, which is not her job description. Why do I bring this up? This shows the problem, one of the main problems that we have at the UN. UN, as I noted early on, is supposed to be protecting and leading the effort in the issues like the Uyghur genocide. And to this day, UN has not done anything. There's no emergency session, even though this has been in its sixth year. No single powerful or statement from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. No, nothing. Why China pays one-third of the UN operations budget. So we need to look at the ways to reform UN system. We need to also look at the ways to establish an international legal mechanism to address humanitarian crisis, genocide, atrocities without begging countries like China, Russia to join the effort.
Yeah.
As one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the China and Russia always oppose. It makes us handicapped. I could not do anything too meaningful to hold those bad actors, perpetrators to account. Under the international law, the International Genocide Convention, to be specific, there are more than 50 countries. There are 150 countries that are signatory. As I noted earlier, only 8 have taken up a position by officially recognizing the Chinese atrocities against the Uyghurs as a genocide, but the rest of them have not done anything. Under the Article 1, the state parties need to call out, stop it, and hold the perpetrators to account. To this day, even though our country has led the effort, there's no legal mechanism under the international law to hold those to account. Mm. So we need to reform the UN, and you need to create a mechanism that will help to address the genocidal issues and also prevent the next one from happening. As for my book, I felt I had no choice but to bring a story of the Uyghurs through my own personal experience to the world. My work for the Uyghur people has come at a great cost, but I owe it to my conscience and to the world to use all of the tools at my disposal to bring awareness to these horrors and implications for the entire world. I must say this: it's been a painful process, even since writing the book. I received a devastating news exactly about 7 weeks ago, no, 8 weeks ago. My father passed away, and I failed to secure his exit from PRC. And my mother remains trapped away from her American family, American sons and grandchildren. I don't know if I will ever see them again. I got sanctioned by Communist China last December in retaliation against the U.S. government's policy responses, including sanctioning a Chinese military medical academy and its 11 affiliates for developing brain control weaponry to be used against the Uyghurs and others, and the U.S. government's decision to diplomatically boycott the Genocide Olympics and going after four Chinese officials with a sanction under the global Magnitsky sanction. So I get retaliated against for the policies and pronouncements by U.S. Congress and U.S. president. And not only that, I got sanctioned by Russia last month. Two of the world's worst human rights violators has sanctioned me. So I guess that's a badge of honor.
So what about, you know, I know that you and I chatted a little bit about it. What did you find that truly surprised you when you were researching the book?
I hope that everyone, anyone reading it, would recognize the gravity of the situation now and possible new world order should we fail to stop the Chinese genocidal regime.
Yeah,
I find a quite disturbing similarities between what happened to the Uyghur people in the last several years. And what happened to the Jewish people and Romas under the Hitler regime. The way that they treated women and children, the way that they enslaved the prisoners, the way that they used global fanfare like the Olympics to justify and normalize their behavior, and the way that they use threats to buy out silence. We have seen this repeatedly. So I believe that the international community should make the never again after the Holocaust meaningful, and we should not let this happen to another people. So it may sound very disappointing, disparaging, but sometimes I feel that the slogan, this vow of promise, never again, sounds like a slogan to me. Some people just say it because it sounds good. Some politicians like to repeat it in their speeches because it gets clap phrases. So I think this has to be meaningful, and a fulfilling promise. I'm deeply disturbed the similarities. As I wrote in the book, I have a chapter called Reinvention of Genocide. Making comparison, I have a chapter in the book, China's War on Uyghur Women. I have a chapter on the modern-day slavery, calling it a message from the slaves. So all of those three aspects, I clearly point to the direction as if that China has borrowed the pages from Hitler's playbook.
Yeah, it does feel to me a little bit like we're reliving the 1937, 38, 39 time frame all over again right now, as the world is sort of facing this competition for the new world order between the liberal democracies and the rising autocracies. Nuri, we only have about 5 minutes left. What else should the American people know about international laws and norms with regard to human rights that we haven't maybe discussed today, things we should absolutely know about? Maybe I can give you about 3 minutes to share your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I noted that this is on us. This problem is on us. During the process of researching and writing this book, it was striking to uncover specifics of the similarities between, as I noted, the CCP and Nazi mindset, including collective punishment based on religious and ethnic background, rounding up social elites and thought leaders, violence against women and children, dehumanization of the entire population. And one other thing that we haven't talked about, the disturbing nature of this technologically enabled authoritarianism.
Right.
And the world's indifference to another genocide. There's still massive failure regarding early detection and prevention of atrocity crimes. I have attended meetings organized by various organizations. They work to prevent atrocities, but how do you prevent atrocities when the early warning signs are so clear in the case of the Uyghurs and the Rohingya Muslims? Do we have to act afterwards? Even acting afterwards will not be meaningful, will not be effective. So I would call on the American people to do a few things. One, stop investing in this technology firms in the Silicon Valley. There's a guy by the name Shamas Palihapitiya of Social Capital. People like Elon Musk of Tesla, Herbert Dies of Volkswagen, many others are essentially complicit in the ongoing genocide. Elon Musk opened a dealership in Urumqi right after the United States government recognized atrocities as a genocide. What more does he need to do the right thing? So stop investing in these companies. So when you stop investing in these companies, they will get the message. And this guy, Shamas, who is a immigrant, a child of an immigrant from Sri Lanka, enjoyed the taste of freedom both in Canada and the United States, and quite shamelessly said that who cares about the Uyghurs? This is just, he's being honest, ironically, but that's the nature of the people that we're dealing with in the high-tech sector in the United States. And also, as a consumer, you should stop buying products made by made in China, specifically those consumer products, cotton products, agricultural products. There are 83 brands have been implicated. And also, those of you who care about environment, please don't forget that those solar panels made, the solar panels that you put on your roof to save or conserve energy and save the planet, has been made by enslaved Uyghurs using dirty coal. So this should be concerned to you. So I call on the consumers to boycott products coming from China if it's one of those companies sourcing from China. With the enactment of yesterday's law, this will be less of a problem, but as a consumers, we maybe end up paying a little bit more, but at the end of the day, it's a moral thing to do. If you wanted to see the list of companies that have been implicated, go to ASPI, Australian Strategic Partnership Institute website, to look up that report. It has a long list of companies. And also there's a specific website set up by civil societies, the End the Uyghur Forced Labor, .org. That also has a lot of information. And you can go to my organization's website, as John introduced, the Uyghur Human Rights Project, UHRP.org, that also has a useful links. And finally, if you have extra dollars, contribute to organizations like UHRP. That has been doing a phenomenal job. Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of today's edition of National Security This Week. Nuri Türkel, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been incredibly enlightening.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Hey, where can our listeners find a copy of your book, No Escape?
You can order a copy of my book at your favorite online bookstores, such as Amazon, or you can go to my website, nuridurkel.com, and there's a link where you can order your audio, hardcover, or ebook version of No Escape.
Yeah, and I'll spell that for our listeners. It's NURYTURKEL is Nuri Türkel. And folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for being a listener to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.